field trip to the Department of Corrections. House members.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Judiciary Committee. And we have two bills today for testimony, public hearing. And I'm going to go ahead and open up the first public hearing on Senate Bill 95.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 95 is filed at the request of Governor Kitzhoff with the Oregon Health Authority. It prohibits an insurer from not defending a health care practitioner or health care facility against a claim arising from a malpractice claim or other negligence claim that is based on disclosure to the patient or patient's family by the health care practitioner or health care facility.
All right, thank you. We have four people that are scheduled on the witness list, so what we're going to do is we're going to bring up two panels at this point. First one is going to be Janine Smith and Mick Alexander, followed by Bethany Higgins and Gwen Dayton. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Morning.
Chair Posansky and members of the committee, I'm Jane Smith, the Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research in the Oregon Health Authority, and we wanted to talk to you for a moment about how Senate Bill 95 was developed. It adjusts the ability to encourage disclosure of medical errors. I'm joined today by the Mick Alexander, the co-chair.
Yeah, we only know Ms. Mick.
Don't get us confused now.
This is an official title. He's the has been the co-chair of the Policy Board's Medical Liability Task Force, and I believe you received a copy of the task force's report electronically, and also our testimony today. The revisions proposed in Senate Bill 95 are supported by the Health Policy Board's overall action plan, which was released to and given to all of you at the end of 2010. In the plan, it supports the setting of standards for safe and effective care and acknowledges that the one key next step for doing that is changing the state law to remove the barriers that discourage physicians and facilities from disclosing medical errors. And this was our intent in trying to draft the language in Senate Bill 95 to take a significant step towards better standards for safe and effective care. It stems from the work of the task force, which was a diverse stakeholder group, including physicians, attorneys, and business and consumer representatives. The board had instructed the task force to focus their attention on improving patient safety, ensuring compensation for medical injuries, and reducing medical errors, frivolous lawsuits, and liability premiums. So that really was what they focused on. The idea was whenever they looked at a potential option to recommend, it was it going to improve the safety for a patient, and would those who were harmed be able to be effectively compensated, and could we reduce the collateral costs of medical liability? We felt, and from our look at this, that the disclosure of adverse events is a critically important element of patient-centered care. The benefits of disclosure reduce the fear that makes providers reluctant to discuss adverse events with the patient. Facilitates the patient participation in decision-making and enabling an informed patient consent. It gets timely and appropriate compensation to patients harmed by negligent medical errors, and it explores the causes of patient injuries and prevents avoidable reoccurrences. Our research revealed that the disclosure of errors to patients may reduce rather than increase the incidence of lawsuits, and when disclosure is coupled with early offers of compensation, it may reduce litigation costs and the size of indemnity payments. So as originally drafted, Senate Bill 95, there has been some concerns specifically about the language, and we've been working with the Medical Association, the trial lawyers, and the Patient Safety Commission and others to develop the right mix of language. But I think the essence of this is that the goal is to try to reduce the barrier to disclosure. And we really feel that this is important if we're going to achieve the triple aim of improving patients' health, improving the quality and patient satisfaction of health care, and increasing health care costs. And with that, I'll turn over to Mick.
Mick, before you get started, I'm hearing feedback, and I'm just trying to figure out if...
I'm not sure what it was. It was kind of like almost a beat.
that was her.
Probably, this was probably too close to the...
All right, yeah, all right. I want to make sure the tapes, everyone can hear, and we don't have all this noise on the tapes. Thank you very much. Mayor?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just want to be a little bit more specific to what Dr. Smith said about the task force and about Senate Bill 95. We did explore this early disclosure and offer. Actually, the task force, you should know, as Dr. Smith said, was a very diverse group, and staff did a wonderful job of gathering a lot of information. I mean, I literally had about four notebooks about this thick of law review articles and medical articles and all kinds of things about a lot of these issues. And one of the things that was a concern and that led to the language of Senate Bill 95, not the dash one, which I want to talk about as well, is the concern that by disclosing an adverse event, a healthcare practitioner might expose himself or herself to a denial of insurance coverage under the duty to cooperate. And so the only language that we actually drafted is the language in the original Senate Bill 95. We took a position that we weren't going to try to draft language, but just look at concepts, and this is the only exception to that. Now, the dash one amendments, I have to say, were not drafted by the task force. The only discussion about the nature of what an apology is centered around, we wanted to clarify it without saying whether we wanted to expand it, restrict it, or anything else. It was just a matter that was a discussion about clarification. So speaking on behalf of the task force, it should be made clear that the Senate Bill 95 dealing with the insurance coverage really came directly from the task force. The dash one amendments, I don't know if Janine offered them. I don't know where they were offered from, but that was a discussion that was very, very generalized within the task force. So I think when I signed up, I said I didn't sign up in favor or against, but neutral on the bills, which I try to maintain because of my position as a co-chair. But that's the background on 95. And the only comment that I would have on some of the issues in 95 is that I can't remember, quite frankly, the language that ended up in our report, whether I ever looked at it in any detail, but I think the issue that comes up with regard to the insurance coverage is whether or not the language is broad enough to encompass both the duty to defend and the duty to pay, which are these separate duties under the contracts. And I think in terms of the insurance coverage portion of the bill, that needs to be clarified to make sure that we have all the duties under the insurance policy that are not going to be affected under the disclosure to patients. And so that's what, we're 95, I think, where the issues are with the original bill.
All right. First of all, I understand that basically we're just getting some testimony today as to what has happened. I understand there's the work group and others may be continuing to meet to bring some additional amendments and really fine-tune this before we actually take action. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Right. Questions, Senator Wissett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Will this have a, if this bill passes its current form with the dash one amendment,
would it have a quantifiable effect on the cost of medical liability insurance premiums, first? And secondly, can the adverse event disclosure be used against the defendant in court? And third, in the task force, did you have legal experts who defend claims on your task force?
If I can respond, Mr. Chair, Senator Wissett, taking the last question first, we did have defense attorneys on the task force. We had plaintiff's attorneys. I'm a plaintiff attorney, if some of you know that, some may not. So we had both groups in terms of the legal resources available. In terms of increasing the cost of medical malpractice premiums, which was your first question, we didn't do any study on that, so I couldn't really tell you anything very authoritative. My own feeling would be I doubt it, but I doubt it would increase the rates because I don't think the issue would come up very often. As far as the use of apologies in court, they're generally inadmissible currently, And that's what the dash one amendments are intended, apparently, to at least clarify what the apology means. There's some substantive issues in there that the advocacy groups will be talking about, but there's currently a law that protects expressions of apology from being admissible in court. Now, how far that goes to other forms of disclosure is something that I think the dash one amendments are intended to at least discuss.
Thank you. Just a comment, as a veterinarian, I know that that's that prohibition can get can be avoided by a nimble attorney in about 30 seconds. So, thank you.
So just for the record, we have not received the dash one, so we understand that you're putting some stuff on the record, but council doesn't have it. You get it.
It was in here.
Okay. Okay, I stand corrected. All right, you need to update your file there. All right, any other questions for this panel?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess I'm trying to figure out what problem we're solving here at this point. Adverse events are already reported to the Patient Safety Commission. It's a safe haven for dealing with system errors. So what are we trying, what problem are we solving here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I think that the problem, and it may be a solution chasing a problem, I don't know, but the issue is insurance companies have a duty to cooperate in all of their policies, and there is at least the concern that if an insured went to a patient and said, we made a mistake and your husband died or something like that, that the insurance company could say that's a breach of the cooperation clause under our insurance policy, and therefore we're denying coverage. I can't, to be quite honest, I don't even know of an anecdotal example of that, but I do a bit of coverage work, and we had other people did coverage work, and so that we saw that as a potential problem that I guess we wanted to head off at the pass, so to speak.
Cruz and Chair Prozanski. What was brought up was the independent providers versus we've listened quite a bit and got a nice overview of what Peace Health does, a lot of disclosure and offer, but they're employed physicians and they're all under one big policy, so they can encourage disclosure to the patient, have a good communication with that patient about what went on, potentially limit their them taking the provider to court or the facility to court. What was a concern is if you're an outside physician, not part of that system, then that was the concern that was raised, that those providers, insurance companies, may fail to support them in that disclosure.
Mr. Chair, I guess my concern is, and we dealt with a bill or a couple bills in health policy relative to the Patient Safety Commission, which is still in its infancy in a lot of ways, and it's been voluntary up till now. For example, I think all but three hospitals are complying at this point. We are trying to expand the universe, but we're doing it in a voluntary way at this point. It's a safe haven. I think we're going to get incredibly positive results over time. I'm a little concerned about messing with this baby before it's actually up and walking.
And Senator Cruz, Chair Prozanski, I think the essence of what we were asking of the Patient Safety Commission is less of a concern than trying to reduce the concerns for the providers that they're not going to have representation for claims. And so I think it's reducing the barrier to disclosure is the essence of what definitely needs to be addressed. The Patient Safety Commission is probably just starting to get up to speed, but that is more about a reporting. This is more about the provider-patient relationship and being comfortable with being able to talk to the patient. If the Patient Safety Commission isn't ready to take on the additional language in here, that's fine, but I think what we really want to focus on is not precluding a conversation between the provider and the patient.
And just for the record, we're going to have Bethany Higgins up next, and she represents Oregon Patient Safety Commission.
Yeah, I guess, Mr. Chair, and, you know, I may have some issues with the bill in and of itself, but the nexus is also troubling to me, so.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much. Our next panel, Bethany Higgins and Gwen Dayton.
Mr. Chair, Bethany's been on board for less than 7 weeks now, and we're really putting her through the meat grinder.
Well, she looks like she's holding up.
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Przamski, Vice Chair Cruz, nice to see you again. Good morning, members of the committee. I am Bethany Higgins. I'm the new administrator of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. I'm here to testify today specifically related to the language in the original bill, Senate Bill 95, that says access to the Oregon Patient Safety Commission's adverse event reporting program to all ambulatory health care providers. Number one, I want to say that the Patient Safety Commission obviously reports, supports transparency in reporting and also disclosure. We require written disclosure in our participation for our participants in the reporting program, number one. So transparency is an important cornerstone of patient safety, and we recognize that. Two, though, there is also a lot of evidence in the ambulatory environment related to what the issues are for improving patient safety. So there's medication safety and administration problems, there's communication, teamwork development, other things that we can do to perhaps improve transparency, but also develop programs that will help impact safe care, which is really all of our shared goal. The fiscal impact, if the intent of this bill, and that is not what I just heard, by the way, but if the intent of this bill was to require a mechanism for all ambulatory health providers for the patient safety system in our reporting program, let me just say that the time involved and the money involved in doing that is quite large. I did submit written testimony that gives you a minimum estimate of an annual cost to even start developing a mechanism like that. It wasn't clear to me sort of what the definition was around. Are we talking all licensed providers, for example? But if it's just a matter of partnering, for example, with the Oregon Medical Association, the Health Authority, and others to develop programs to improve patient safety, then we're certainly in the throes of doing that kind of work today, and we would continue to do that.
Thank you. Chair Przamski, Vice Chair Cruz, I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm General Counsel for the Oregon Medical Association. I also head up the OMA's quality initiatives. I will be brief this morning to indicate that we share the same goal as others who have testified, and that is removing barriers and improving the comfort level that physicians may have in being open with their patients about adverse events that may have occurred in their care. So we are committed to working with all of those who are testifying, as well as others who are working on this bill, to make it as good as possible. In that respect, we're also quite supportive of the Commission, have been since its inception in 2003. Ms. Higgins and I have already sat down and talked about areas that we could work together to improve patient safety in the ambulatory arena. We look forward to continuing those conversations and that partnership. So I know I very much appreciate her commitment to that, and we share that. The last issue that I'll raise today that's not in this bill, but we just wanted to indicate our general support for further study of an administrative system or other alternatives to our current litigation system that might support appropriate patient recovery, but also perhaps be more supportive of lesser costs, less defensive medicine, some of the other goals expressed by the liability task force. It's not included in this bill, but it's something that we continue to care about and continue to support broadly. Thank you, and I'll answer any questions you may have.
All right, great. Questions for the panel? Senator Wissett.
Thank you.
First for the OMA, you said that the initial research suggests that disclosure of errors into patients may reduce rather than increase incidence of lawsuits and costs and so forth. Could you make that, give us reference to that, those studies, or make those studies available to us so that we can look at that?
Senator Wissett, you're asking for studies that indicate that disclosure will actually reduce the incidence of lawsuits?
Yes.
I'm glad to. Thank you.
And the second is just a comment for Bethany. I think the intent of the bill is really not relevant. The text of the bill is what is implementable. So, I mean, if there's a problem in your mind in the text, the intent is really irrelevant. Thank you.
Other comments, questions? Ladies, thank you very much. Was there anyone else who
wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 95?
Senator Cruz.
Thank you. And language is seems to be important in this building, but I'm a little concerned with the term of art here, negative consequence of patient care that is unanticipated is usually preventable, and that seems like a wide open door to me. I would hope we could find some better terms of art.
I'm glad to hear that you're volunteering. So what we'll do here, we're going to have this group continue to meet, and I would like y'all to keep us engaged, and I'm going to ask Vice Chair Cruz to kind of have an ear open for discussions. He's is kind of our resident healthcare person on the committee, if that's all right.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 95, understanding that we probably will see this sometime in the future once we get some additional work done by the work group. And I want to thank everyone for coming and setting the record as to where we're going and what the intents are. So with that, we're going to close the hearing on SB 95. We're going to go ahead and open up our hearing on Senate Bill 411.
Chairman, Mr. Penny, Senate Bill 411 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. The bill establishes standards and procedures for determining if a youth in delinquency matter is unfit to proceed as a result of mental disease or defect.
All right, thank you. I have a number of people scheduled on the schedule for testifying, and I'm going to start at the top of the list and work down. We'll do a panel of three. I believe it's Bill Busca, Marcus Fant, and Wendy Johnson. Whoever would like to get started, if you just identify yourself.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz. My name is Bill Bushka. I'm the manager of Children's Mental Health System for the Addictions and Mental Health Division within the Oregon Health Authority. Senate Bill 411 is the result of many years of work and partnership with the Oregon Law Commission and many stakeholders throughout the state. We've also analyzed many other state models, including Virginia, is probably the core one which we followed. Senate Bill 411 would provide guidance within the juvenile code for the ability for the court to use aid and assist processes for juveniles within the juvenile court. My colleagues can describe more of the court process, but I'll talk a little bit more about what the Oregon Health Authority would do within the statute.
It does a couple of key things for the Oregon Health Authority to work with the court and work with youth within this process. It provides structure within the bill to outline a structure for the evaluations, not only for the evaluators, what the evaluation to help deter the court to determine whether a youth can aid and assist in their defense, but also the structure of the report and the flow of the report from the evaluators back to the court to help them determine. And it sets a strong value within that process of the evaluation that the professional who's going to be doing the evaluation will go to where the youth is, so that a youth won't have to be removed from their current placement to a location for the purpose of the evaluation. Once the court determines that a youth can't aid and assist in their defense, it outlines a structure for restorative services that will be provided for the youth so they can learn and understand the process and the proceedings and assist their attorney in their defense. Again, with the restorative services, there's a significant value that the restorative services provider will go to where the youth is currently placed to provide the restorative services. They are really education-based services to really help the youth understand the process and what is going on. I believe you also have dash one amendments that are hopefully provided, and if you don't have them in front of you, they will be coming soon. But it really is just clarification as the Department of Human Services and the Health Authority are discovering more and more how we're going to be and working together in the future, just our roles. So it's just a little bit of clarification there with the roles between the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services. So again, my colleagues will describe more of the legal process, but clearly the Addictions Mental Health Division supports the policy direction within Senate Bill 411. Again, it outlines a clear process to ensure a youth can aid and assist in their defense. It outlines the evaluation process and the process for restorative services, and provides really clear guidelines for the court around the speed of which these processes happen. And again, a fundamental value within the bill is that both the evaluation and the restorative services will be brought to where the youth is currently placed, and that there's no need for removal of that current placement, just for the evaluation or these services. So I want to thank you for allowing me to present testimony, and I'd be happy to answer further questions.
All right, stand by, and we'll get the testimony from the other two, and then we'll open up the panel for questions. Wendy, are you next?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. This bill does come to you with the recommendation of the Oregon Law Commission, unanimous recommendation, and it also comes out of the Juvenile Code Revision Work Group, which many of you know is a longstanding work group of the Commission that works on improving Chapters 419A, 419B, and 419C, the three juvenile chapters of the ORS. This bill has failed the last two sessions, because it's died in Ways and Means Committee. It's come out of the Judiciary Committee each time, and we're back again, this time believing it is filling a gap in the law, and it's an important gap to fill. Let me just give you a little more context. The Due Process Clause of the U.S. Constitution says you have to be able to assist in your defense. And what that means is you need to be able to understand the proceedings before you. You need to be able to cooperate and assist with counsel, and you need to be able to participate in your defense. That's commonly understood, that none of you could be prosecuted in a criminal court unless you can assist in your defense. The question is, and we have a statute that provides that, a process for dealing with that aid and assist issue so that you can't be prosecuted if you can't aid and assist. The question is what to do in juvenile court with kids. Do they have the same protection that they can't be adjudicated is the term, if they can't aid and assist in their defense? And it's been recognized in court that, yes, they have the same right. The problem is Oregon does not have a process for raising the issue. When do you file a motion? When do you have a hearing? Who does the evaluation? How much does it cost? All these issues, none of it's defined in statute. So we have this constitutional right, but so far Oregon hasn't paid for the procedure to make sure that right can actually happen. So this bill would set out all the procedures to raise the issue, provide restorative services if a juvenile is found not to be able to aid and assist, provide services, and then go ahead and if they're not able to aid and assist even after services, to how to end that whole process and continue it as well. I'd be happy to walk through each section of the bill, but that's sort of the basic issue is what do we do so that both the defense and the prosecution know what the rules are, as well as provide guidance to the court. And as Mr. Bushka explained, we need direction to the agency on what they're supposed to do to provide these services so you can aid and assist. My colleague to my right will talk about the public safety issues, because if a child is or a juvenile is unable to aid and assist, some counties are dismissing the petition, and because they can't aid and assist and we don't have a process to raise the issue, so they'll dismiss the petition and the juvenile will end up back in the community and can reoffend. And so we have public safety concerns as well without having a process. Basically, we have a different process going on in every county and in present under the present system with no guidance. And so that's why the juvenile code groups got together and presented the bill before you that addresses the concerns of the juvenile departments, of the juvenile defense attorneys, of the DAs, and of the courts, and of the state agencies. So it comes to you with that recommendation. Mr. Chair, I'd ask you whether you'd like me to walk through all 11 sections of the bill, or...
I don't think it's necessary. I think your hurdle is not here in judiciary. As you said, we've moved it out of the substance committees twice. We're going down to Ways and Means for a third time, I assume. And so I don't think we need to be briefed on it section by section. And we do have the report,
right.
And I'll allow members to go through that and have questions and contact you directly.
Chairman of the committee, for some reason this bill does not have a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee.
Yeah, but it needs one.
It may very well need one, but which gets into an interesting question if they already have the rights.
I see how it wouldn't have one.
Yeah. All right, Council, since you're volunteering, you can check with the President's office as to what they think we should be doing on this. It would seem to me that it would be going to Ways and Means, knowing that there is going to be a financial investment that needs to be made.
Mr. Chair, just to continue, in your packet you have the summary and the report from the commission that explains section by section. And then also after the report you have a Linn County opinion, and that came out in February of 2010, and it's another reason why we believe it's important to pass this bill this session. We have this case from Linn County which involved several juveniles. The judge down there heard several cases at the same time and issued the opinion. And the opinion concludes that the adult provisions of aid and assist shall apply to juveniles. In the absence of having a set of statutes, the adult provisions would apply. And that creates all kinds of problems in terms of the procedures, and the timelines are very long for adult aid and assist evals and reports back, and the court procedures is a very different process. The fiscal is always an issue, and obviously because the aid and assist statute has been argued to apply to juveniles, there is a question of, well, we already have this due process requirement now, so the cost is out there in form of some sort. It's just those restorative services are not accounted for in the budget.
All right. So, before we go there, question, now that you brought up the opinion, first of all, it's Linn County. So we have a new rule, or say we have a rule that's there in Linn County. Do you know if any of those cases went up on appeal?
Yeah. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, I talked to the clerk last week in that judge's chamber, and to their knowledge, none of the cases have gone up on appeal. But it's not because there was not an adverse finding. There was a deal of sorts, so there was not an adjudication.
All right. Bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'll go after Senator Bonamici, if that's okay. The question I have for you is, the requirements that you have in your bill greater than what is in the adult system currently? In other words, would there be additional expenses if this is passed as opposed to the current adult system, which is now, at least in Linn County, applicable to juveniles?
Chair Przanski, Council Taylor, I don't think I'm qualified to answer the question on the cost. The procedure and the defense is the same. The services and such would be different. For example, the adult provision says that you can take the person to the hospital for 30 days, and our bill would say, no, you can't remove a juvenile from their current placement unless you have a court order, because we want to keep them in the community or in their current placement, and then only if it's necessary, and the max would be 10 days. So it would be cheaper in some respects. It's a different placement for juveniles than it is for adults. So to figure out what the cost would be beyond my expertise.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I understand, and Senator Cruz is probably more familiar than I am with this, the cost in the adult system is about $450 a day, from what I understand. And if that's correct, and you're going to treat in the community, then that's usually less than that. I know that from the discussions we've had with the PSRB.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is your bill, and very well, may be less expensive than the system that Linn County now says exists, at least in Linn County.
Defer to the department on the treatment issues.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, one of the differences that we're looking at with language in this bill is really what restorative services are. They're really educational-based services that are curriculum-based, where a professional will go to where the youth is and really help the youth understand what the court process is about, who their attorney is, what the jury does, what are the different options that they have, to really help them understand. If they need active mental health services or developmental disability services or other kinds of services based on their treatment needs, that really would already be provided in the system today. What's really different about this is the restorative services are really educational-based services that may or may not happen and happen with irregularity and inconsistency throughout the system. And so that is, that's really much different in this concept than in what's available in the adult code. So it's really not access to treatment services. It's really about restorative services to help the youth understand the process of what's going on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Wendy might have clarified this with Mr. Taylor's question, because Wendy, you mentioned that in some counties they're just dismissing the petitions, but then in Linn County, I didn't get a chance to read through this, is it saying that they need to follow the adult process, or can they still dismiss a petition if they so choose?
Chair Przyjanski, Senator Bonamici, the opinion says that there is an aid and assist defense. It's not really a defense, but it's an issue that you can raise before you can be adjudicated. And then it says the procedure would be the adult provision. So and that happens in adult court, too, that you can dismiss the petition. It's just the process for raising the aid and assist issue, getting the evaluation, having a hearing. It would be the adult process that would apply.
Thank you for the clarification. Other questions?
All right. I tell you what. I'm going to go. I think we'll do that.
Okay.
Marcus?
Thank you, Chairman Przyjanski, Vice Chair Cruz, and other members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today regarding Senate Bill 411. My name is Marcus Spant, and I am a juvenile counselor from Clackamas County Juvenile Department. I carry a specialized caseload of youth who have mental health issues. I often work with youth who have lower cognitive function. The issue of aid and assist comes up regularly with the caseload of youth that I work with. I think that there are several arguments that can be made in support of Senate Bill 411, including due process rights, equal protection between jurisdictions, costs from pending litigation, moral and ethical obligations to the youth before he or she becomes an adult, and what it will cost when the youth becomes an adult and suddenly the rules change. However, I would like to focus my comments today on two very important issues, the first being community protection and the second being fiscal costs. Frankly, aid and assist language does not exist in juvenile code in what Wendy referred to as 419A, 419B, and 419C. It only exists in ORS 161.370. That is an adult statute. In Clackamas County, juvenile offenders are allowed to raise aid and assist as an issue because it is a due process right. However, the state is not allowed to seek restorative services because that code comes from the adult statute. So on one page, it says aid and assist and describes that, and the very next section describes how we can get evaluations and how we can provide restorative services. We are not allowed to use that code at all. The provision for restorative services is what makes Senate Bill 411 helpful for the state to protect the community and provide appropriate treatment for youth. Without restorative services, if youth are found unable to aid and assist, petitions are then dismissed and the offenders are returned home without any supervision and without any treatment. The juvenile justice system then becomes a revolving door and youth are in and out of police and juvenile department custody. For example, I have a youth on my caseload that has been referred to the juvenile department 28 times. The last 19 referrals have been closed with no intervention because a youth has been found unable to aid and assist. 13 of these referrals were for criminal allegations. Each time there is a victim. The cost has either been physical injury or property loss or damage. There are costs for local police department who respond each time this youth gets out of control. Sometimes several officers have to respond for a single incident. One day, this youth was brought to my juvenile department 3 times in a single day. All of this costs our community. Additionally, many of these youth receive services from multiple agencies, including developmental disabilities, mental health, special education, and the Clackamas County Mental Health Organization, which is the agency that manages the Oregon Health Plan for some of these youth. All of these agencies are voluntary. If youth and or his or her parents refuse to cooperate with that agency, then there is nothing the agency can do. treatment plans cannot be mandated. Attendance at treatment can't be mandated. It's for this reason that again and again, when I contact these workers, they are always eager to have me on a case because finally they believe somebody has the authority to ensure that the youth will comply with treatment and ensure that the parent will comply with the treatment plan that the team is trying to work on. And we quit wasting our money and our time on treatment plans that can't be administered. With an aid and assist statute in the juvenile code, these youth may receive juvenile justice intervention. The safety of the public is addressed. Other treatment services will be more effective. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today and share Clackamas County Juvenile Department's support of Senate Bill 411. I'm eager to answer any questions you may have.
All right, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. Number one, does there currently exist nationally recognized standards? Because what we have in here is to allow OHA to develop standards when we deal with reciprocity and a whole lot of other things. Any time we have recognized standards that we can put in place, I think we're better off. So is there anything like that currently in existence?
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, is your question about the standards for the evaluators?
Yes, Section 3. It's Section 3. Standards for psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers. I'm assuming there are educational standards that presumably on a national level that are recognized. I'm wondering if that exists.
I'm not necessarily part of those boards and those organizations, but there are forensics groups of child psychiatrists and psychologists that do have standards in place, and that we've had consultation from child psychiatrists and psychologists as part of this group to help us outline those standards if we were to do that.
Yeah, Ms. Chair, part of the reason for that question is, number one, if they exist, that's what we ought to be referencing rather than setting up a rule process. And number two, in a lot of our disciplines in this state where we have different standards than the national ones, it becomes a barrier for providers to come into the state because then they've got to jump through some more hoops. So reciprocity becomes an issue with this. So if there is something like that, I'd be interested in seeing it. It just as an addition. I support the direction here. I'm wondering how far in the bill we can go before we start running into dollars. And the reason I ask that is OHA has currently, without even doing this, about an $850 million hole in the budget. So that makes this very problematic. I'm just wondering if there's some process that we can do before we get, because you get into the providers, you are talking dollars, and especially, you know, if you've got to provide the services where the youth is, which may work well up in this part of the state, in other parts of the state you may have to be importing people to deliver the services or exporting the kids to get the services, and so that does come into some dollars. So I guess I'm just wondering if there's, rather than fail with the whole thing, because the budget crisis may prevent the whole package, if there's some process we can at least get into statute. And I don't expect an answer right now, but that might be worth looking at.
Chair Przanski and Senator Cruz, the work group has discussed how to lower that fiscal, and we've talked about doing a pilot. We've talked about just doing the procedure and not the services. But frankly, a pilot raises even more constitutional questions. If you have a due process right, you can't pick which counties get to exercise it. I mean, that just...
Right.
That would... We already fear litigation in that we don't have a process now, and they have this right. So a pilot process has been discussed, but it wasn't looked upon very highly, especially by the Department of Justice, because of what that implications are. Putting in statute just the process, but not requiring services, has the same problem that Mr. Fond explained. Then we have to let them go, and we have this public safety problem, and it's a problem for especially the district attorneys to put in a process, but not require restorative services, which allows you to
suspend the adjudication, but then eventually try the juvenile and hold them responsible when they are able to aid and assist. But if you're not providing services, there's no incentive for the district attorneys to support it because of that. So we really have thought about that issue and how to lower the fiscal, and the honest answer is it costs money to provide the services. It's not a lot of money. We fear that an appeal could actually cost a couple of appeals to cost the state a whole lot more money than just providing what's needed for these kids.
May I respond to this?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. One of the things that's currently happening is different jurisdictions handle this issue differently. Some judges see their way around the fact that this does not exist in juvenile code, and they borrow from this adult statute. Part of this adult statute says that an offender will be sent to the state hospital, and it goes on to say that if the offender is under the age of 18, they'll be sent to a facility designated by the Department of Human Services. Frankly, that statute is designed to refer to Measure 11 offenders who are under the age of 18. But they use that to justify it for juveniles in juvenile court, and they then send them to Children's Farm Home. This committee has already recognized that you threw out the dollar of $450 a day. I don't know exactly what Children's Farm Home is. I know that it's a very expensive facility, and I have youth on my caseload that are there. But that is an awful lot more expensive for all of these jurisdictions that are sending youth to Children's Farm Home than it is to provide educational services for a youth in their home or in their community.
At issue here, frankly, is whether a youth understands the legal process. Do they know where the judge is? Do they know where the defense attorney is? And this educator is simply going through these rules and teaching them about that.
That can be done very, very cost-effective within their community, as opposed to sending them to a residential mental health facility to receive those services, which is what we're currently doing haphazardly throughout the state.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, which is what I was. If we can do that process, but does that process trigger everything else? Is the question at this point? I mean, you know, and so they're found to be not competent. Does that trigger an automatic referral to services? And I know in many parts of the state, the wait list for those services can be quite long. So. But I understand the wanting to get the process so they're informed. I'm just questioning whether that could be separated from everything else.
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, just to clarify a little bit, we currently have a program that is operated by Trillium Family Services called the Secure Adolescent Inpatient Program, and that's a program that we set up a number of years ago when we closed the Child and Adolescent Treatment Program at the Oregon State Hospital. And that the Secure Adolescent Inpatient Program really provides the same services within the statute requirements that we have as were provided at the state hospital. So the requirements under when a court orders under 161370 around the determination, both the determination of fitness and then when a youth can't proceed, can be provided and are provided within the Secure Adolescent Inpatient Program. But they're most ideally suited when a child has an active psychiatric treatment need. These are really high-cost services, much higher than the $450 that you mentioned earlier, and really are a finite resource. And there is really a lot of question within the juvenile courts about when to do that, how to do that. When we provide both the evaluation and the restorative services and send a report back to the court isn't quite sure what to do, what the time frames are. So it's very inconsistent, and it's a really inefficient use of those resources. But again, if a youth does need active psychiatric treatment, they should get that. And this bill does not talk about that or add any additional costs for those kinds of services. Those are already things we do within the treatment system and will continue to do. This just really clarifies the issue of an evaluation, a quality evaluation, what that means, and then what the court process is to determine whether a youth can assist in their defense. And if they aren't, then providing the restorative services, not active mental health treatment, that is already provided in our system in other ways.
Thank you. Senator Whitsett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wendy, this problem must not be unique to Oregon. Have you studied the other states, what the other states are doing, and particularly the states adjacent to Oregon, to address this problem?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Woodsuit, we did look at other states, and as Mr. Bushka explained, Virginia has the best model out there, and that's what we look to, because it was they have a similar size as Oregon in terms of the number of juveniles, and their process was most akin. But other states obviously are recognizing the same due process right and providing the services as they can. I'm not familiar with every state, but we did look at how to best fill this gap in Oregon, and this is what we came up with. It's very much akin to what the adult process is. It looks very similar, except that some of the timelines and some of the details are a little different, but it's not rocket scientist of how to do a need and assist evaluation and what that process looks like. It's a normal court process of having the hearing and having follow-up reports, and so the process is very akin to what we already have and what other states do have.
Do other adjacent Western states have programs that are similar to the Virginia plan, or is that just one that you happen to select? Because I get back to it can't be unique just to Oregon. So how are other Western states handling this process?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Woodsuit, I don't recall what Washington, for example, or California have done. We started this project 6 years ago, and so I've moved on, but I can get back to you to give you more detail on those other states.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions, comments? Susan Silver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question about the fiscal, because obviously that has been more of an issue than the substance of this bill. So is this in the governor's budget?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Dingfelder, we had requested that it would be, but because of it's a new program listing, it was not. And my understanding from LFO is the fiscal should be somewhere between $700,000 to $800,000.
So without that in the budget, I mean, I'm certainly supportive of the policy. I'm just concerned about that. Why it wouldn't have the same fate that it has in past sessions unless we can figure out the fiscal situation. And I certainly am concerned about, you know, that we don't have consistency among the counties and making sure that we have consistency policy and due process. But obviously, and I'm not on that Ways and Means Subcommittee, I'm on another one, but certainly that sounds like it may be an issue. But that's not for this committee to figure out, I guess.
Not at this point. That's jurisdictional on that. All right, I'm going to bring up the next panel unless there's any other comments or questions. Thank you very much. Last panel we'll have scheduled at this point is Julie McFarland and Kurt Miller. Will there be anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 411? And I'll let y'all decide on who wants to go first.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Julie McFarlane. I'm a supervising attorney at Youth Rights and Justice, formerly the Juvenile Rights Project, and I am also the chair of the Juvenile Code Revision Work Group at the Oregon Law Commission. I co-chaired with District Attorney from Multnomah County, the subwork group on this bill, and which has previously been presented. Oregon is among a minority of states that do not specify a statutory procedure for determining when juveniles are incompetent to proceed to juvenile adjudication. And the fundamental concepts of due process require that persons who are mentally incompetent are not required to proceed to trial. These cases are being heard in all of the courts, juvenile courts, in this state, and there are a significant, if somewhat small, number of these cases being heard. And I think that's why when we brought this issue to the Oregon Law Commission, we had a collaboration, and we had a committee that was chaired by a defense attorney and a prosecutor, because both the defense and the prosecution can see the problems with the lack of procedures in our current statute. The previous speakers have addressed some of the problems that arise, but we have youth who are charged and who are unable to aid and assist. Their attorneys raised that issue, I think, 6 years ago when we started working on this. Very often defense attorneys were frustrated by the fact that when they raised the issue, they would have difficulty convincing their courts to, in fact, grant the motion when their client was clearly mentally incompetent to proceed. That, however, has changed. There has been, the tide has turned in favor of the defense in that regard, because courts have become more and more informed, and more courts are granting these motions for determination of the ability to, the competency to proceed, and then are struggling with what to do with these youth once they grant those motions. We see, as evidence of the turning tide, the Linn County opinion, which was an en banc opinion involving a number of youth in that county. That opinion has been widely circulated among the defense bar and judges who have struggled with this issue, and we are seeing in my county, in Multnomah County, we're seeing more cases where judges are looking to the adult statute and are directing services to be provided to youth when a youth has been determined to be not competent to proceed, but where restorative services could make the youth competent. And within the last year, I've had a case where a youth was provided restorative services by DHS, which really didn't want to do that because they didn't have any funding to do that, but they were provided, and the youth was subsequently restored, and after that entered a plea to the charge and now is in appropriate services for the offense they had committed. So I think that the difference now, as compared to the prior two sessions in which this bill was put forward, is that I believe because of this turning tide, the fiscal has changed. We are seeing, and we will continue to see, more cases where there will either be an order to DHS by the courts to provide restorative services, or there will be a run on very costly inpatient hospital-type settings. In preparation for this hearing, Ms. Johnson put together a comparative chart, which has not been submitted to the committee, but which shows the timelines for aid and assist under our bill and aid and assist under the adult statute, which I would just add parenthetically is really out of date and should be updated to look more like our bill, because the adult statute just doesn't have deadlines or timelines for getting things done, and as a result of which, I think this committee and the legislature has heard a lot of information and testimony already about how adults get stuck in the state hospital and stuck on the mental health caseload with no resolution. Our bill provides really good, tight timelines to make sure that that does not happen. There was a good deal of discussion in the work group because of the fiscal issue of putting forward just a bill that had the procedure up to the provision of restorative services, which is the fiscal, the large fiscal impact, although there's some fiscal impact for certifying psychiatrists and psychologists to perform evaluations. The major impact is in terms of the restorative services. And I think the difficulty in the looking just at it from the defense bar perspective, it would be advantageous to have the procedure so that we could move forward clearly. But you would have the same problem at the end that you have now applying the constitutional standard, which is that there would be no direction and courts would do something. Clearly, under the juvenile code, the courts now have the authority to dismiss the petition at any stage of the case, that's in the statute, or to do what we call convert the case from a delinquency case to a dependency case. To order restorative services is not something that is specifically provided for in the juvenile code, but the court often views itself as a court of equity, having those sorts of powers, and looks to kind of its favorite provider of services, DHS, and makes those orders, which puts DHS in a very difficult position. So when we discuss the possibility of just having the procedure up to the provision of restorative services, we decided as a group that we did not want to put that forward to the legislature. So Senate Bill 411 represents a major law reform effort and should be passed. It will implement tight timelines so that resources are not wasted. And I would submit that a careful analysis will show that resources are now being wasted because of the lack of a procedure. Without passage, courts will continue to inconsistently apply the constitutional standards required by Drope and Dusky, which are in your materials. And when the juvenile court finds that youth are incompetent to proceed, the court and parties will continue to struggle because there is no mechanism to provide restorative services. The result is that either the case is dismissed or the youth is committed to DHS, which is unable to provide the services to restore the youth and merely keeps the youth to the frustration of all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Kurt Miller, and I represent the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I did submit some written testimony, so I'll just jump to the highlights that we're concerned with specifically. And the biggest concern that I think that we have is that this seems to preclude any movement of the juvenile from their current position to another position for evaluation and treatment. So the concern that the District Attorney Association has with that is that many of these youths are being held in pre-adjudication detention with serious episodes of like psychotic disorder or active delusional phases of their bipolar or something. I'm sorry, I'm not the medical provider for that side of it. However, the charges that they're being held on are serious offenses like arson and your higher level assaults for those that are 14 and under. And when we are in pre-adjudication detention, we're limited by the statute of 419C150 to only 28 days without good cause continuance and then a 56-day max without the ability to proceed beyond that 56 days unless there's voluntary consent of the youth, which I don't think we would be able to get if they were unable to aid and assist. So my concern lies in when we're bringing these services to the youth as the bill posits that the evaluator will then have to come into detention and do the evaluation. The restorative services will have to come in there, but yet the evaluation itself has 60 days to have a turnaround, 30-day for the initial part and then a 30-day extension. So that gets us beyond our pre-adjudication detention without even the ability to provide restorative services. So I think that the DA's Association is very much in support of the bill as far as getting us a solid procedure and a solid way to determine who conducts the evaluation and who provides the restorative services. It's just what do we do with that select few youth that are being held in detention. As the other panel pointed out, they do, in our county and Marion County, we very frequently move them to the children's farm home, which is a secure setting so that they can have inpatient treatment. But the language of this bill seems to preclude that movement because it says you can't move them for the sole purpose of an evaluation, which is what we would be doing from pre-adjudication detention to the children's farm home. So the language that we would suggest for the change would be that you can't move them from a lesser restrictive setting to a more restrictive setting. We already have the concept of least restrictive placement inside the juvenile detention statutes for pre-adjudication detention under 419C145. So this would then allow us, if the youth is in detention, to move them from that more restrictive setting to a less restrictive setting like an inpatient treatment. And that would allow us then to avoid any concerns around the 419C150 56-day maximum. Also, the provisions that we have now setting out the restorative services, at the end of those restorative services, if they are not successful, we're back to where we started, and we have no choice but to either dismiss or look to commitment. And as far as I know, there's no real civil commitment procedure for juveniles. There's talk that that's possible, but the common practice that I've seen is it's more so just a turning around and doing a dependency petition under the 419B100 section. So I think that the time frames for the restorative services are limited, much like the adult sides, but that doesn't really take into account the seriousness of the offenses and what we're looking to accomplish. But I think our main brunt would be that we would like to see a change in the language so that we can move from detention to inpatient treatment.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Moldovich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have a question, but just a comment that in light of some of the comments that were made today about the changes because of the Linn County opinion and the cost, I think that somebody needs to really look at the fiscal analysis to determine if that's appropriate, and I'm not volunteering to do that. I'm just making a comment.
Don't worry.
I need to do that.
All right, well, thank you. The other thing, Kurt, Wendy took some notes. I'm not sure if you've actually expressed the concerns from ODA. Sounds to me like that language may need to be put in as an inclusion if it's not already covered for that. And if you can make certain that if you'll work with her so they can have that information and with staff, that would be great. All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much. Once again, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 411? Not seeing anyone. We're going to close that public hearing. Tomorrow we're scheduled to meet, and I know that the weather may get iffy.
We may be stuck here before the day's out.
So maybe we won't have to worry about it. We'll all be here on time tomorrow. So let's just plan. Let's plan on 8:30 start in the morning, and with that, we're adjourned.
Bicycles working.